Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into something vital, prepping you, the learner, for your pediatric nursing exam.
Yeah, it's a huge topic. Pediatrics covers so much ground, you know, from tiny newborns all the way up to adolescents.
Exactly, and each stage is so different. So our goal here is to kind of consolidate the really key information you need across the major body systems, development, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Think of this as your focused review. We've told from a bunch of study guides, growth and development, mental health, cardio, GI, GU, infectious diseases, meds, musculoskeletal, neuro, respiratory.
And also that really important piece on atraumatic care and working in different settings like hospitals, clinics, schools.
Right. So the mission for you, the learner, is pretty clear. Mm. Help you get a solid grasp on these core concepts efficiently.
So you feel ready for that exam, not, you know, totally overwhelmed by the sheer volume of it all. Okay, let's dive in. Foundation first. Pediatric growth and development.
This is where it all starts, and it's fascinating because kids change so fast. They're definitely not just mini adult.
Totally. Let's kick off with infancy that first year. The physical growth alone is just wow.
It's remarkable, isn't it? You see incredibly rapid weight gain. Most infants will double their birth weight by around 5 months or so.
And triple it by their first birthday.
Exactly. And they shoot up in length too, usually about 10 inches in that first year.
And it's not just size, right? Their skills are exploding. Head control, for instance.
Mm-hmm. By about 4 months, they should have pretty good head control. You know, when you gently pull them up to sit.
Right. If there's still a significant head lag after that, that's something you'd want to investigate further. It could be a developmental flag.
Definitely. And their body proportions change too. That big head they start with becomes more balanced with their body over the year.
Okay, let's talk motor skills. Gross motor first, the big movements.
Yeah, so around 2 months, lifting their head and chest a bit during tummy time.
Then rolling over, usually tummy to back first, maybe around 4 months.
Typically, yeah. And then 5 to 6 months, sitting with some support, often starts maybe some early crawling attempts.
And by 9 months, they're often really moving, crawling properly, pulling themselves up to stand.
Maybe even cruising along the furniture, taking those assisted steps. And by 12 months, you often see those first independent steps, or at least confident cruising.
Such huge milestones. And fine motor, those smaller, more precise movements.
They develop fast, too. That grasp reflex is there from the start, around 1 month.
By 4 months, they can usually grab things with both hands.
Mm-hmm. Transferring objects between hands, that's often around 6 months.
And the pincer grasp, using the thumb and forefinger, that's huge.
Huge, around 9 months, usually. They'll just pick up small things.
Like Cheerios.
Exactly. And by 12 months, they're often pointing, waving bye-bye, picking up small objects pretty well.
It's amazing how this ties into those primitive reflexes they're born with, right? They need to disappear for these voluntary movements to take over.
Precisely. Think about the Moro, or startle reflex.
The rooting and sucking for feeding.
Palmar and plantar grasp. Tonic neck, that fencing pose.
And the Babinski in the foot. Knowing when those should fade is important.
It really is. Like the Moro, rooting, sucking, those are usually gone by 4 to 6 months. If they stick around too long, it can signal potential neurological delays.
Because the higher brain centers haven't quite taken over from the brainstem reflexes yet.
Exactly. And the Babinski, where the toes fan out, that should usually be gone by the time they're walking, around a year old. Yeah. Tracking these is key in your assessment.
And all this physical stuff is happening alongside massive social and emotional growth. Erickson's trust versus mistrust stage really sums up this first year.
Absolutely. They're learning. Yeah. Can I rely on my caregivers? Is the world safe?
And that consistent, responsive care, feeding them, comforting them, that's what builds that fundamental trust.
So connecting this for you, the learner, think about those key milestones at specific check-in points. 2 months. Social smile, maybe starting to lift their head.
4 months. Cooing sounds, rolling over maybe, reaching.
6 months. Responding to their name, babbling starts.
9 months. Crawling is common, maybe saying mama or dada, even if they don't attach meaning yet.
Right. And 12 months. Often walking, understanding simple commands like, come here. You'll be assessing these constantly.
Which brings us to nursing considerations for infants. Safety, safety, safety. Choking hazards, safe sleep.
Mm-hmm. Back to sleep, always. Empty crib, crucial messages.
Feeding breast milk or formula, starting solids around 6 months, developmental surveillance, checking those milestones.
And supporting parents. Anticipatory guidance, telling them what's coming next, answering their questions, immunizations, infant CPR education.
Okay, let's shift gears to toddlers. ages 1 to 3, the growth rate slows down a bit here.
Yeah, it definitely decelerates compared to infancy. They'll typically gain maybe 3 to 5 pounds a year, grow about 3 inches.
Head size gets more proportionate. The fontanelles, the soft spots.
Should be closed by about 18 months, usually. And by age 3, they generally have all 20 of their baby teeth.
But their motor skills are just exploding, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Gross motor really takes off, walking independently around 1 year.
By 2, running, kicking a ball, starting stairs, maybe still needing help with those.
Right. And by 3, jumping, riding a tricycle, maybe balancing on 1 foot briefly. It's amazing progress.
And fine motor keeps refining too.
Definitely. Scribbling at 1 year. By 2, maybe building a small blog tower, turning book pages one at a time.
And by 3, starting to help with dressing, using a spoon pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And psychosocially, this is Erickson's autonomy versus shame and doubt stage.
Ah, the me do it phase. They want that independence.
Exactly. And you see separation anxiety become more pronounced. They understand they're separate from their caregiver now.
And the famous no phase, that negativism is totally normal, right? Testing boundaries.
Completely normal. Part of asserting their will. Language also just blossoms here.
From just a few words at 1 year?
To maybe 50 words and starting 2-word phrases by age 2.
And by 3, wow, like 200 words, 3-word sentences, following simple directions.
Yeah, hugely. So key milestones. Walking at 1, running in simple sentences at 2, more imaginative play and understanding commands by 3.
Nursing considerations for toddlers. Safety is still huge, childproofing the house for these little explorers. Car seats, always.
Absolutely. And toilet training often becomes a focus. Educating parents on readiness signs is key.
Play is crucial, too. You often see that parallel play, right?
Yeah.
Playing near others, but not quite with them yet.
Exactly. Okay, on to preschoolers, ages 3 to 6.
Growth continues to slow down a bit more.
Yep, steady but slower, maybe 3 to 5 pounds, 2 to 3 inches a year. But their coordination, fine and gross motor, really improves.
Drawing more recognizable things, using scissors, hopping, skipping, riding that tricycle like a pro.
Mm-hmm. Psychosocially, they're in Erickson's initiative versus guilt stage.
They're eager to try new things, plan activities, make up games.
Full of initiative. But they can also feel guilty if things go wrong or they think they've overstepped.
Yeah.
Lots of imaginary play, starting to understand friendships, gender roles.
Yeah. Key milestones. Tricycle and hopping at 3. Drawing shapes, maybe a person, at 4.
By 5, maybe writing some letters, counting, using more complex sentences. Language is really developing.
Nursing considerations. Safety education becomes important teaching rules. Play is more creative, more social. Maybe cooperative play starts.
And dental care. Good brushing habits, regular checkups are vital. Okay, next up, school-age kids, 6 to 12.
Growth here is pretty steady but slow, right? Couple of inches, a few pounds a year.
Right. Motor skills get more coordinated. Great time for sports. Fine motor skills are well-developed. Vision problems might start to emerge now, though.
And Erickson's stage, industry versus inferiority.
Yes. Big focus on mastering skills, schoolwork, hobbies, social interactions. Success builds a sense of competence. Industry.
While struggles can lead to feelings of inferiority, friendships and cooperation become really central.
Mm-hmm. Developmentally, you see better focus and memory around 7. Independent reading, often by 9. By 11 or 12, more complex thinking, planning activities.
Nursing considerations. Safety shifts, focus bike safety, sports safety, now internet safety too. Bullying can be an issue.
Health checks like vision screening, keeping immunizations up to date. Supporting socialization through group activities.
And finally, adolescence, 13 to 18.
Puberty hits, bringing rapid growth spurts. Girls usually start earlier, maybe 8 to 13. Menarche, the first period, typically follows breast development by a couple of years, average around 12 or 13.
Boys start a bit later, maybe 9 to 15. First sign is often testicular enlargement.
Correct. And you see all those secondary sexual characteristics developing in both sexes.
Erickson's stage here is identity versus role confusion, the big who am I question.
Exactly. Exploring identity values, beliefs, sexuality, future goals. Peer relationships are absolutely central. Huge desire for independence from family.
Milestones. Around 14, 15, exploring relationships, figuring out identity.
By 16 to 18, ideally developing a more stable sense of self, thinking about long-term plans, making bigger decisions.
Nursing considerations. Safety around potential risks, substance use, driving, sexual activity.
Mm-hmm. Comprehensive sexuality education is crucial. Contraception, STIs, healthy relationships. Encouraging independence while still providing that safety net and guidance.
Okay, that covers the developmental stages. Now let's pivot to something really core to pediatric nursing: atraumatic care and the different places you'll provide care.
This is so fundamental. Kids aren't just small adults. How we care for them needs to minimize physical and emotional stress. Let's think about where you'll see these kids.
Right. Obviously, hospitals, acute care, specialized units, dealing with everything from pneumonia to post-op recovery to mental health crises requires specialized skills.
Definitely. Then you have outpatient settings, clinics, doctor's offices, routine checkups, immunizations, managing chronic conditions like asthma or diabetes.
Lots of parent education happens there too. Preventative care is huge.
Absolutely. And don't forget school nurses. They're right there managing chronic conditions daily, handling first aid, providing mental health support, doing health education.
They're really on the front lines in that community setting. Advocates for student health.
It's also helpful to know why kids end up hospitalized. Under five, it's overwhelmingly respiratory stuff. Bronchiolitis, pneumonia.
As they get older, respiratory is still big, but you also see more mental health issues like anxiety, depression, injuries, GI problems.
Mm-hmm. And for adolescents, at pregnancy-related issues, mental health continues to be significant, and injuries, especially things like car accidents, sports injuries.
And we absolutely have to remember how stressful hospitalization is, not just for the child, but the whole family.
It starts even before they get there, doesn't it? The worry, the fear of the unknown, maybe past negative experiences.
Yeah.
Parental anxiety is high.
Then during the stay, separation from home, family, friends, fear of pain, procedures, needles, loss of control.
And even after discharge, there can be anxiety about recovery, managing care at home.
Psychologically, it can lead to fear, anxiety, even depression. For some kids, especially with chronic conditions, it can have lasting effects.
And, you know, kids pick up on their parents' stress so easily, they absorb that anxiety, mirror those reactions.
Which is why it's so important for parents to try and stay calm, but we also know how incredibly stressful it is for the parents, too. They're worried, maybe feel guilty.
Right. And how a family copes depends on so many things: their culture, past experiences, their support system.
So how can we, as nurses, help kids cope better in the hospital?
Preparation is key. Explaining procedures simply, using age-appropriate tools like dolls or videos, it demystifies things.
Parental involvement is huge. Having a parent there provides so much comfort.
Immense comfort.
Yeah.
And distraction. Games, toys, books, music, videos. Anything to shift their focus away from the scary stuff.
Play therapy, too, with trained specialists can be amazing for helping kids process feelings.
Absolutely. Child life specialists are invaluable. They use play to prepare kids for procedures, normalize the hospital environment, help them understand what's happening.
Thinking about the nursing care itself, there are sort of four phrases.
Yeah, starting with the introduction, a warm greeting, introduce yourself, build that initial rapport.
And building trust, providing comfort, acknowledging their feelings, making them feel safe.
Next is decision-making. Involving the child when possible, even in small choices, gives them some control. And always respecting parental input, their partners.
And finally, comfort and reassurance. Both physical comfort positioning, blankets, and emotional reassurance explaining, praising their bravery.
And for procedure specifically, we can do a lot to reduce stress. Minimizing pain is number one.
Topical anesthetics before needles, maybe sedation if needed, and definitely distraction.
Having parents present helps immensely. And communicating clearly, non-threateningly, explaining what's happening.
Now, a quick but important point on safety, restraints.
Yeah, absolutely, a last resort. Only to prevent harm. Needs a written order within an hour and a face-to-face evaluation by the provider within that same hour.
Good point. And transporting kids safely.
Always use the right equipment, cribs, stretchers with straps. Monitor them closely during transport.
Discharge instructions need to be crystal clear, right?
Totally. Care guidelines, follow-ups, meds, warning signs, what to watch for. Family education is key for that smooth transition home, teaching them how to manage care, give meds, when to call for help.
This all ties into family-centered care, doesn't it? Empowering families, collaborating with them.
Exactly. Seeing them as partners, supporting them emotionally and psychologically, not just medically.
And atraumatic care is the philosophy behind it all, preventing or minimizing those physical and psychological stressors.
Using things like non-invasive methods when possible, reducing discomfort, and those distraction techniques we talked about, games, videos, stories, music.
So the core principles of family-centered care are really about respect, recognizing differences, building on strengths, supporting choices, being flexible, and truly collaborating and empowering families.
And the benefits are clear. better satisfaction, better communication, better emotional well-being, less anxiety, and often improved health outcomes because families are more engaged.
The goals of educating families tie right in. Promote understanding, support their decisions, give them skills and resources, encourage self-care, foster that collaboration, and make sure those discharge instructions stick.
Mm-hmm. And when working with diverse families, a cultural assessment is so important. Asking respectfully about things like, who's the main caregiver? Who makes decisions? What's their support system? Any dietary needs or restrictions? Traditional health practices? Religious or spiritual needs?
Good questions to ask. And what about recognizing if parents might have trouble with reading or health literacy? What are some red flags?
You might notice difficulty with forms. Maybe they frequently miss appointments or seem non-compliant with meds.
Maybe medication errors happen at home, or they can't really answer questions about the treatment plan.
Right, or they might just avoid reading materials altogether. Recognizing that helps you tailor your communication and education so they truly understand how to care for their child.
Okay, that's a great foundation for care principles. Let's shift now to another incredibly important area, pediatric mental health.
Yes, this is getting much more recognition, thankfully. The impact is huge. About 1 in 5 kids experience a mental health disorder.
And the really scary statistic is that maybe 80% of them don't get the services they need.
Exactly. And that increases their risk for so many problems down the line. Academic failure, social difficulties, family stress, substance abuse, even self-harm and suicide.
It's so complex. What influences a child's mental health?
It's a mix of things. Biological factors, genetics, brain chemistry, how the brain develops.
Environmental factors too, right?
Yeah.
Family dynamics, stress, trauma, neglect.
Peer influences become huge, especially for older kids, bullying, social pressures. Social factors like poverty or discrimination play a role. Cultural influences too.
And psychosocial factors, mm-hmm. like early attachment experiences, adverse childhood experiences.
ACEs.
Definitely.
All those things shape their mental landscape. So how do we evaluate a child?
A really thorough health history is crucial. Developmental milestones, family history of mental illness, current stressors, any changes in behavior or mood.
Mm-hmm. A physical exam helps rule out medical causes, looking for things like malnutrition, developmental delays, neuroscience.
Sometimes a child's drawings can offer insights, especially for younger kids who can't articulate feelings well.
True. And careful observation is key. Watching for things like aggression, impulsivity, distractibility, poor attention span, unusual motor activities, signs of potential issues.
So the nursing process starts with that comprehensive assessment, the history, the physical, maybe labs to rule out medical stuff like thyroid issues or lead poisoning if there are delays.
Right. And interventions focus on supporting the child, creating a safe space, therapeutic communication, building trust.
And supporting the family education, counseling, connecting them with resources, encouraging their involvement.
If medications are used, it's about safe administration, educating the family on side effects and use, monitoring effectiveness and reactions.
And supporting whatever therapy they're in, CBT, play therapy, encouraging participation, offering emotional support.
Okay, let's talk specific disorders. Learning disabilities
affect about 10% of kids. Difficulty in specific areas like reading, writing, math, despite having the potential.
Nursing role involves awareness, support, referrals for evaluation, helping develop coping strategies.
Intellectual disabilities affects about 1%. Limitations in intellectual functioning and adaptive behaviors, starting before age 18.
Right. IQ around 70, 75 is a guideline, but adaptive functioning is key. Nursing role is support with daily living, finding resources, encouraging social skills.
Autism spectrum disorder, ASD. Onset usually in early childhood.
Yeah, maybe 1 in 88 kids. Characterized by challenges with social skills, communication difficulties, and often restricted, repetitive behaviors or interests. Distress with change is common.
Early warning signs are important to know, like not babbling or pointing by 12 months, not using single words by 16 months, any loss of skills.
Definitely. Nursing involves therapeutic management with specialists, assessments, family support, and providing that structured, consistent environment they often thrive in.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, very common, maybe 10% of school-age kids.
Characterized by inattention, impulsivity, distractibility, hyperactivity. Different subtypes exist.
Nursing role includes assessing symptoms, helping with behavioral management strategies, supporting school accommodations, monitoring medication side effects if they're prescribed stimulants or non-stimulants.
Tourette syndrome involves multiple motor tics and at least one vocal tic for a certain period.
Nursing is about education for the child and family, emotional support, Important to know, it often co-occurs with things like anxiety, OCD, depression.
Eating disorders, pica, rumination, anorexia nervosa with that intense fear of weight gain, bulimia nervosa with binging and purging.
Nursing involves assessing for malnutrition, electrolyte imbalances, mental health issues, supporting the child and family, collaborating with the team, educating on nutrition and body image.
Anxiety disorders are actually the most common mental health issue in kids, maybe 10-30%. Various types exist.
Nursing management. Assess symptoms, the worry, the physical complaints like stomach aches, avoidance behaviors. Medications like SSRIs might be used, often with therapy like CBT.
And sadly, we have to talk about suicide risk. Risk factors include mental health disorders, family history, stressful events.
Warning signs are crucial. Changes in behavior, withdrawal, talking about death, giving things away. We need to be vigilant.
And finally, the link between abuse and violence and mental illness. Physical, sexual, emotional abuse, neglect. They all can have devastating long-term psychological consequences. Recognizing signs and reporting is critical.
Absolutely critical. Okay, let's shift gears again and tackle pediatric cardiovascular disorders.
Right. Understanding fetal circulation is key here. Before birth, oxygen comes from the placenta, not the lungs.
So blood bypasses the lungs using two main structures, the foramen ovale.
An opening between the right and left atria.
And the ductus arteriosus.
A vessel connecting the pulmonary artery to the aorta. Both should close shortly after birth when the baby starts breathing air.
And in normal postnatal circulation, they do close, establishing the separate circuits to the lungs and the body.
Exactly. Now, heart disease in kids is either congenital present at birth due to structural issues or acquired develops later due to illness.
Let's focus on congenital first. We can broadly categorize them as acyanotic and cyanotic. Acyanotic means
a left-to-right shunt. Oxygenated blood from the left side mixes back into the right side and goes back to the lungs. No initial cyanosis usually?
Examples. ASD hole between the atria. VSD hole between the ventricles, the most common one.
PDA, the ductus arteriosus, fails to close. Coartation of the aorta, a narrowing of the aorta.
Let's look closer. VSD. The hole lets oxygenated blood flow from the left ventricle to the right, increasing blood flow to the lungs.
Right. Can cause fast breathing, sweating with feeds, poor growth, a murmur. Large ones can lead to heart failure.
ASD, the hole between the atria, might be asymptomatic if small, might even close on its own by age 5.
But larger ones can cause fatigue, poor growth, a murmur, maybe heart failure later on.
PDA, that persistent connection between the aorta and pulmonary artery after birth.
Leads to signs like bounding pulses, wide pulse pressure, maybe CHF. Treatment can be meds like indomethacin or surgery.
Coarctation of the aorta, that narrowing, obstructs blood flow to the lower body.
Key signs. High blood pressure in the arms, low in the legs, weak pulses down low, risk of stroke, need surgery or balloon angioplasty.
Okay, now cyanotic defects. These involve a right to left shunt.
Meaning deoxygenated blood from the right side gets into the systemic circulation, causes that bluish color, cyanosis.
Classic example, tetralogy of Fallot, TOF. It's four defects together.
Right. VSD, pulmonary stenosis, narrowing, an overriding aorta, and right ventricular hypertrophy.
Signs. Cyanosis, especially with exertion, those characteristic TET spells where they get very blue and irritable.
And they might instinctively squat during a spell that actually helps increase blood flow to the lungs temporarily, clubbing of fingers and toes over time. Need surgery.
Another critical one, transposition of the great vessels. Aorta and pulmonary artery are switched.
Creates two separate circuits. Deoxygenated blood goes body, heart, body. Oxygenated goes lungs, heart, lungs. Medical emergency.
Presents with early significant cyanosis. Needs prostaglandin E to keep the ductus arteriosus open for mixing until surgery.
And hypoplastic left heart syndrome, severely underdeveloped left side of the heart. Needs complex surgeries or transplant.
Congestive heart failure, CHF, is a common complication of many CHDs. Goals.
Decrease the heart's workload, increase its output. Meds are key. Digoxin to improve contractility.
Diuretics like furosemide to reduce fluid.
Vasodilators like ACE inhibitors to make pumping easier. Plus nutritional support, rest.
Using dioxin in kids requires real caution. Checking that apical pulse for a full minute.
Yes, hold if it's too low, below 90 to 1 in 10, usually for infants. Watch closely for toxicity signs, nausea, vomiting, bradycardia.
And remember, low potassium increases the risk of digoxin toxicity. Monitor those electrolytes.
Okay, now acquired heart disease, Kawasaki disease.
Acute vasculitis, inflammation of blood vessels, especially coronary arteries. Big risk.
Signs. High fever over 5 days, strawberry tongue, red eyes, swollen red hands, feet that might peel, rash, swollen neck lymph nodes.
Treatment is IVIG and high-dose aspirin initially, then lower-dose aspirin for antiplatelet effect.
Nursing. Cardiac monitoring for aneurysms, IV fluids, managing fever and discomfort.
Rheumatic fever follows untreated strep throat.
Right, an autoimmune reaction about 1 to 6 weeks later. Attacks heart valves, joints, tissues.
Diagnosis uses Jones criteria. Major things like carditis, polyarthritis, chorea. Minor things like fever, high ESR, positive strep test.
Treatment. Long-term penicillin to prevent recurrence, aspirin NSAIDase for inflammation, maybe digoxin diuretics if CHF addressed.
And when listening to heart murmurs, you need to describe them carefully.
Location, timing, systole diastole, intensity, great IMI-6, quality, harsh blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Pitch, how position changes it.
Quick study tips. Cyanotic blue, coarctation, check for extremity BPs. To us, spells quadding helps, digoxin plus low-K, danger, Kawasaki, coronary damage risk, ano IV gasa. Rheumatic valve damage risk, mosapenicillin assa.
Perfect summary. Okay, let's shift to the gut pediatric GI disorders.
Key concepts here. High nutritional needs for growth. Fluid electrolyte balance is crucial and easily disrupted, and their immature systems make them vulnerable. Let's start with congenital anomalies.
Cleft lip and palate. Big issue is feeding difficulty due to poor suction.
Remember the ESSR feeding method. Enlarge nipple, stimulate suck, swallow, rest.
Exactly. Post-op positioning is vital too. Lip repair, side lying or upright, palate repair, side or abdomen to help drainage. Watch for respiratory distress during feeds.
Tracheoesophageal fistula, TEF, abnormal connection between esophagus and trachea.
Think the three C's, coughing, choking, cyanosis, especially with feeding. Also, excessive saliva, aspiration risk, respiratory distress, medical emergency, high risk of aspiration pneumonia.
Imperforate anus, no anal opening, red flag, no meconium passed within 24 hours, needs surgery.
Hirschsprung's disease.
Yeah.
Missing nerve cells, ganglion cells, and part of the colon, causing obstruction.
Symptoms, no meconium, belly distension, constipation. Diagnosis via biopsy usually. Treatment is surgery to remove the bad section, maybe a temporary colostomy.
Pyloric stenosis. Thickening of the pylorus muscle blocks food leaving the stomach, usually in young infants.
Classic signs. Projectile vomiting, non-bilious. Maybe feeling an olive-shaped mass in the belly. Dehydration, always hungry. Diagnosis via ultrasound. Treatment. Pyloromyotomy surgery.
Okay, on to GI obstructions. Into susception.
Telescoping of the bowel into itself. Cuts off blood supply. Most common under age 2.
Classic signs. Sudden, severe, intermittent belly pain, kids draw knees up, vomiting, concurrent jelly stools, blood mucus, maybe a sausage-shaped mass.
Diagnosis and often treatment is with a barium or air enema. If that fails, surgery.
Malrotation and volvulus. Malrotation is abnormal positioning. Volvulus is when it twists, cuts off blood supply. Very dangerous.
Signs. Sudden bilious vomiting, green-yellow, pain, distension, needs emergency surgery. Nursing. NPO, NG tube, IV fluids, monitor perfusion closely.
Appendicitis. Inflammation of the appendix. Pain starts around belly button, moves to RLQ, McBurney's point.
Also nausea, vomiting, fever, rebound tenderness. Watch out for sudden pain relief, could mean rupture. Nursing, pre-op care, NPO, pain control, monitor for peritonitis.
Now some chronic conditions. GRD, gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Some reflux is normal in babies, spitting up.
Yeah.
Becomes G or R with complications or bad symptoms.
Like irritability, back arching, poor feeding, maybe vomiting, maybe not. Silent reflux.
Treatment starts conservative. Elevate head of bed. Keep upright after feeds. Smaller frequent feeds. Maybe acid reducers if needed.
Constipation. Super common, often functional diet, withholding, stress.
Treatment often involves Miralax daily for months, maybe an enema initially, setting up a toilet routine, increasing fiber and fluids.
All right, quiz time on GI. Question one, what are the three C's of TI?
Question two, what assessment is crucial if a newborn hasn't passed meconium in 24 hours?
Question three, what does ESSR stand for and when is it used?
Question four, what type of stool is classic for intussusception?
Question five, what age group most commonly gets intussusception?
Question six, name two key physical findings in pyloric stenosis.
Question seven, what's the primary life-threatening risk with volvulus?
Question eight, what are some signs that infant reflux has become pathologic GERD?
Question nine, how long might Miralax be used for chronic constipation?
And question 10, what's the typical pain pattern in appendicitis? ponder those as we move to pediatric GU genitourinary disorders.
Okay, GU system. Kids' kidneys do the same jobs as adults. Detox, hormones, fluid electrolytes, acid base. But there are differences.
They need more fluid per body weight. Their kidneys are less mature, can't concentrate urine as well.
Right, and their larger body surface area means more insensible fluid loss, makes them prone to dehydration.
Common labs and diagnostics: urinalysis, urine culture, renal ultrasound.
VCUG to check for reflux, cystoscopy to look inside the bladder.
Structural disorders: hyperspadias and epispadias, abnormal urethral openings in boys.
Obstructive uropathy: any blockage causing urine backup, leading to hydronephrosis, kidney swelling.
Vesicoureteral reflux, VUR, that backward flow of urine from bladder up towards the kidneys.
Nursing interventions for obstructions focus on monitoring output, preventing infection, prepping for surgery, educating parents.
UTIs are common. Symptoms are vague in infants: fever, irritability, poor feeding, vomiting.
Older kids have more classic signs: fever, pain with urination, dysuria, urgency, frequency, maybe strong smelling urine.
Nursing management: assess symptoms, get that urine sample correctly, give antibiotics, teach hygiene and hydration for prevention.
And uresis bedwetting, defined as happening after age 5 or 6, can have organic causes like UTI, constipation, kidney issues.
Or non-organic causes like stress, sleep issues, family history. Management starts with ruling out medical causes, then behavioral therapy, alarms, maybe meds like desmopressin.
Now, acquired disorders. Nephrotic syndrome.
Usually idiopathic, affects kids around 2-3 years old. Key features are massive proteinuria, protein in urine,
which leads to hypoalbuminemia, low protein in blood, edema, swelling, and hyperlipidemia, high fats in blood.
Symptoms: frothy urine, severe edema, often starts in face, lethargy. Labs show low albumin, high lipids.
Nursing care: monitor that edema closely, daily weights, strict INO, give corticosteroids, main treatment, yeah. Low salt diet, prevent infection, they're susceptible.
Glomerulonephritis, often post-strep infection, peaks around age 7.
Symptoms: hematuria, blood in urine, looks like cola, edema, especially face eyes, oliguria, low urine output, high blood pressure.
Labs might show high ASO titer, evidence of recent strep, high BUN creatinine, kidney function markers.
Rare sink care. Monitor BP and output carefully, daily weights, low sodium, maybe low potassium diet, bed rest during acute phase, maybe prep for dialysis.
Wilms tumor. Kidney cancer, usually diagnosed around 3 to 4 years old, more common in African-American kids.
Critical point: do not palpate the abdomen, could rupture the tumor.
Symptoms can be subtle, maybe an abdominal mass found by parents, fever, pallor, high BP. Hematuria is rare. Prognosis is generally good with treatment.
Okay, quick GU quiz. Question 1. What are some vague UTI symptoms in an infant?
Question 2. What might the urine look like with nephrotic syndrome and why?
Question 3. What lab test often indicates a recent strep infection in glomerulonephritis?
Question 4. Around what age is Wilms tumor usually diagnosed?
Question 5. Why must you never palpate the abdomen of a child with suspected Wilms tumor?
Question 6. What are key dietary restrictions for glomerulonephritis?
Question 7. What's the term for backward urine flow from the bladder?
Question 8. Name a non-organic factor contributing to enuresis.
Question 9. What are the 4 hallmark features of nephrotic syndrome?
And question 10. What diagnostic test looks for vesicoureteral reflux? Mull those over as we jump into pediatric immunizations and medication administration.
Giving meds to kids isn't just about smaller doses. We need to understand pharmacodynamics, what the drug does to the body, and pharmacokinetics, what the body does to the drug. Kid physiology is different.
Right. Like, they have higher body water content, which affects water-soluble drugs. Liver enzymes aren't fully mature, affecting metabolism.
The blood-brain barrier is more permeable in infants. All these things impact how drugs work and how long they last.
And kidney function. Glomerular filtration is lower in newborns, takes 6-12 months to reach adult levels. So drugs cleared by the kidneys stick around longer, needs dose adjustments.
Administration routes. Oral liquids are common, use syringes for accuracy. Rectal suppositories can be useful for infants or if vomiting.
Ophthalmic for eyes, otic for ears, IM injection site matters. Vastus lateralis, thigh, for infants under 12 months.
Deltoid arm. Okay for older kids, over 12, 18 months, if muscle is big enough. Always use atraumatic techniques, positioning, distraction, topical anesthetics like EMLA cream.
IV meds infusion pumps are standard for accuracy. Double-check those calculations. Monitor vitals closely, especially respiratory rate and O2 sats with opioids or sedatives.
Sometimes temporary restraints like arm boards are needed to keep the IV safe.
And with opioids for pain, monitoring respiratory rate is absolutely critical. Withhold and notify if it drops too low. High risk of respiratory depression.
Common OTC meds. Acetaminophen. Dose is 10-15 milligrams every 4-6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Max, 75 milligrams a day.
Oh.
Overdose causes liver damage. Educate parents about hidden sources in combo meds.
Ibuprofen. Dose 410 milligrams every 6-8 hours has anti-inflammatory effects, too.
Crucial point. Avoid aspirin and salicylates in kids with viral illnesses like flu or chickenpox due to the risk of Reye's syndrome. It's rare but serious, affecting liver and brain.
Okay. Immunization, so vital for prevention. Different types, right?
Yep. Live attenuated weakened virus, MMR, varicella, rotavirus, nasal flu, inactivated killed virus, or parts of it, DTaP, IPV, Hep B, PCV.
Administration, same sites as IM injections, vastus lateralis for babies, deltoid for older kids usually. Atraumatic care is key here too, distraction, comfort holds, maybe topical numbing.
Important contraindication.
Yeah.
Live vaccines generally avoided in immunocompromised kids or their close contacts.
Adverse reactions are rare but serious. High fever, trouble breathing, hives, swelling, anaphylaxis, need epinephrine ready. Flu vaccine, recommended yearly for everyone 6 months and older. Contraindications, severe egg allergy for some types, history of Guillain-Barré within 6 weeks of a prior flu shot.
And remember, kids under 9 getting it for the first time need 2 doses, about a month apart. Lots of details, but crucial for safe practice. Let's move to pediatric infectious diseases.
Why are kids generally more susceptible to infections?
Several reasons. Immature immune system, especially infants. Decreased inflammatory response sometimes. Limited prior exposure to germs, so less natural immunity.
Maternal antibodies wear off after a few months. Their own cellular and humoral immunity is still developing. And incomplete immunization schedules leave gaps.
There are many reportable diseases we track for public health.
Yeah.
Examples, bacterial, pertussis, meningococcus, invasive group A strep, TB viral. Measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, polio, hepatitis, vector-borne, Lyme, Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Understanding the chain of infection helps us break it. Reservoir, portal of exit, transmission, portal of entry, susceptible host.
We break it with hand washing, transmission, vaccines, susceptible host, food safety, reservoir entry, antibiotic stewardship. Protect susceptible hosts.
Hey, fever, how does that happen physiologically?
Infection triggers immune cells to release pyrogens. Pyrogens tell the hypothalamus, brain's thermostat, to raise the set point via prostaglandins. Body then feels cold, shivers, vasoconstricts to generate and conserve heat, raising the temperature.
Assessment for infection, thorough history onset, exposures, immunizations, symptoms.
Physical exam, check skin for rashes, look for dehydration signs, feel lymph nodes with gloves, monitor vitals closely.
Diagnostics might include CBC, CRP, cultures, blood, urine, etc. Maybe CSF analysis for meningitis, chest x-ray for pneumonia.
Isolation precautions depend on how the disease spreads. Standard for everyone. Contact for things like RSV, C. diff, droplet for flu, pertussis, airborne for measles, varicella, TB, need special room, N95.
Sepsis and septicemia, a really serious response to infection. Body overreacts, leads to shock, organ failure.
Common bugs in newborns, E. coli, GBS. Pathophysiology involves complex shifts in blood vessel tone, eventually leading to low blood pressure, shock.
Signs in infants, 3 months. Can be subtle. Fever, low temp, irritability or lethargy, bulging fontanelle, maybe fast or slow heart rate.
Older kids.
Yeah.
Fever, stiff neck, feeling awful, light sensitivity, maybe petechial rash, red-purple spots emergency, nausea, vomiting, poor feeding.
Nursing interventions for sepsis are urgent. Frequent vital signs neurochecks. Get cultures stat, then start broad-spectrum antibiotics, manage fever, provide supportive care, fluids, oxygen.
Let's talk viral exanthems, those rash illnesses. Measles.
Coplex spots in mouth first, then rash starts on face, spreads down. Plus cough, runny nose, conjunctivitis.
Mumps. Parotid gland swelling, looks like chipmunk cheeks.
Varicella.
Chicken pox. Itchy vesicles that crust over.
Roseola. High fever first, then rash appears as fever breaks. Fifth disease. Slap cheek, rash on face, then lacy rash on body, hand, foot, and mouth. Vesicles on palms, soles, and mouth.
Vector-borne and zoonotic diseases. Lyme disease from ticks, classic bullseye rash often. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, also from ticks rash, often starts wrists, ankles, spreads to palm soles. Zoonotic means from animals, kids higher risk due to contact with pets.
Parasites, lice, intense scalp itching. Treat with permethrin shampoo, nitcombing, cleaning everything.
Scabies. Mite burrows under skin, causes intense itching, worse at night, track marks. Treat with permethrin cream all over, maybe oral meds. Treat household contacts, hot water wash for linens, clothes.
Helminths, worms. Pinworms cause perianal itching, especially at night. Hookworms, roundworms cause GI issues, malnutrition. Giardiasis causes diarrhea, cramps. All need specific meds.
And dehydration risk is high in kids with infections. Higher BSA, metabolic rate, immature kidneys. Assess for sunken fontanelles, dry mouth, poor skin turgor, low urine output. Electrolytes can shift, watch for lethargy or seizures.
Common treatments for infections. Antipyretics, antibiotics, antivirals if needed, hydration, oral or IV, maybe anti-itch meds, isolation, and lots of parent education. Okay, on to musculoskeletal disorders.
Musculoskeletal assessment starts with tracking those gross motor milestones at every checkup. Rolling, sitting, crawling in infants, walking, running in toddlers, hopping, skipping in school age. Delays are red flags.
Hip instability is important to screen for early. Newborns might feel unstable. Infants might have limited movement, asymmetric folds. Older kids might limp.
Signs like asymmetric thigh gluteal folds, apparent femur shortening, Allosign. Treatment depends on age. Pavlik harness usually for under 3 months. Hip spica cast maybe for older infants. Goal is to get that hip socket developing properly.
Duchenne muscular dystrophy, DMD. Genetic X-linked recessive, so primarily boys. Progressive muscle weakness starting around 3 to 5 years, usually proximal muscles first.
Classic Gower sign, using hands to walk up legs to stand due to weak thigh hip muscles. Diagnosis, high CK levels, EMG, muscle biopsy, shows lack of dystrophin. DNA test.
Management is supportive. Corticosteroids to slow progression, calcium vit D, maybe meds for heart issues, antidepressants. Physical occupational therapy is crucial.
Cerebral palsy, CP. Not one disease, but a group of movement disorders from brain damage early in life, often before birth. Risk factors. Low birth weight, maternal smoking or infections, birth asphyxia, severe jaundice, kernicterus. Management is multidisciplinary, PT, OT, speech, meds. No cure. Goal is optimizing function. Meds can help spasticity, Bancroft and dantrolene diazepam, or drooling, scopolamine glycopyrrolate, Botox injections, baclofen pumps, or other options.
Scoliosis. Lateral spine curve, 10 degrees, often causes asymmetry of shoulders, ribs, hips.
Mostly idiopathic, unknown cause. Can affect breathing if severe. Look for unequal shoulder hip levels, prominent shoulder blade, visible curve when bending forward. Treatment depends on curve severity and growth remaining. Bracing often for 25, 40 degree curves in growing kids. Surgery, spinal fusion for severe or worsening curves. Mm-hmm. Nursing. Encourage brace compliance, positive body image, pre-post off care, log rolling after fusion.
Key nursing points for MSK. Monitor growth development. Use a team approach for CP. Educate families, DMD progression, scoliosis bracing. Provide good post-op care positioning. Now let's tackle pediatric neuro disorders.
Seizure disorders. Need to differentiate epileptic, brain's electrical activity from non-epileptic, other triggers like fever, injury, infection, metabolic issues.
Epileptic types. Generalized, both sides of brain, often lose consciousness. Partial focal, starts in one area, symptoms vary. Febrile seizures, common in young kids with fever. Status epilepticus is an emergency, prolonged or repeated seizures.
Nursing interventions during a seizure. Assess LOC, aura, duration, airway, incontinence. Protect from injury clear area, guide to floor. Do you not restrain or put anything in mouth? Monitor neurorisk cardio status.
Yeah.
Postictal care. Reassurance, continue monitoring. EEG helps diagnose.
Airway and safety are absolute priorities. Side position if possible, protect head, neck.
Structural defects, neural tube defects, NTDs from early development. Myelomeningocele, most severe spina bifida, spinal cord meninges protrude, causes disabilities, needs surgery, high infection risk.
An encephaly, underdeveloped brain skull, poor survival. Encephalocele brain meninges protrude through skull, microcephaly, small head, often developmental delays.
Hydrocephalus. CSF buildup in ventricles, increases intracranial pressure, ICP, can be congenital or acquired, infection, tumor, injury.
Signs of increased ICP in infants, bulging fontanelle, rapid head growth, lethargy, irritability, poor feeding, vomiting, sunset eyes, older kids, headache, vomiting, vision changes, lethargy.
Management is usually surgical shunt placement to drain CSF, requires close monitoring for shunt malfunction or infection.
Other conditions, craniosynostosis, premature fusion of skull sutures, abnormal head shape, positional plagiocephaly, skull flattening from positioning, managed with tummy time, repositioning.
Head trauma, falls are most common cause, also MVAs, bike accidents, non-accidental trauma, shaken baby syndrome.
Skull fractures, linear depressed, basilar watch for raccoon eyes, battle signs, CSF leak. Compound fracture breaks skin.
Management. Initial assessment. Neurovitals. Cervical spine immobilization if needed. CT scan usually. Monitor for increased ICP. Keep HOP 30 degrees. Maintain airway. Prevent secondary injury. Comfort assurance. Educate parents on worsening signs.
Okay, deep breath. On to pediatric respiratory.
Pediatric airway anatomy is key. Upper airway. Shorter, wider Eustachian tubes. Ear infection risk. Smaller diameter overall. Obstruction risk. Infants are obligate nose breathers.
Lower airway. Fewer alveoli. More compliant chest wall. Less efficient breathing. Diaphragm is main breathing muscle.
Assessment. Look and listen. Increased work of breathing retractions. Nasal flaring. Head bobbing. Adventitious sounds. Stridor. Upper air. Wheezing. Lower airway. Crackles.
Fluid.
Compensation signs. Tachypnea. Fast breathing, grunting, keeps alveoli open. Accessory muscle use. Feeding difficulty is an early sign in infants.
Cardinal signs of respiratory distress. Tachypnea, restlessness, tachycardia, diaphoresis. Remember, respiratory distress comes before cardiac arrest in kids.
General nursing. Airway first. No age-appropriate vitals. Mm-hmm. Monitor fluid loss. Insensible loss increases with fast breathing. Decrease oxygen and band cluster care. Keep calm. Elevate HOB. Humidified O2 if needed.
Common disorders. Otitis media. OM. Middle ear infection, super common due to Eustachian tube anatomy.
Types, acute, AOM, sudden onset pain, fever, effusion, OME, fluid without acute infection, chronic,
right.
Risk factors, bottle propping, smoke exposure, pacifier use, daycare.
Management, pain relief, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, antibiotics, amoxicillin usually for AOM,
great.
Maybe tubes, myringotomy for recurrent chronic issues, prevention, breastfeeding, vaccines, PCV, avoid smoke.
Croup. Laryngotracheobronchitis, viral, causes upper airway swelling.
Hallmark signs, barking cough, like a seal, inspiratory stridor, hoarseness, often worse at night in cold air, peak 6 months, 3 years.
Home care, mild, cool mist, fluids, cool night air, keep calm upright. Hospital, severe, racemic, epinephrine, neb, steroids, dexamethasone, monitor closely for worsening stridor traction, hypoxia.
Bronchiolitis RSV, viral infection of the small airways, bronchioles, peaks winter, spring. RSV is most common cause.
Patho. Inflammation plus mucus air trapping, atelectasis, hypoxia.
Symptoms start like a cold, congestion, then progress to wheezing, tachypnea, poor feeding, retractions, flaring, maybe crackles, cyanosis, even apnea in young infants.
Management is supportive. Fluids, suctioning airways, rest, humidified O2 if needed, hospitalized if severe distress, apnea, dehydration, prevention for high-risk infants. Synagis, pelivizumab.
Epiglottitis, bacterial infection causing severe swelling of epiglottis, life-threatening airway obstruction, often caused by HIB, vaccine preventable.
Classic signs. The 40s drooling, dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, dysphonia, muffled voice, distress, respiratory, also tripod position, high fever, stridor.
Huge GE nursing point, never inspect the throat, can cause complete obstruction. Priorities, prepare for airway management, intubation, keep calm, give 100% O2, IV antibiotics.
Tonsillitis. Inflammation, infection of tonsils, sore throat, trouble swallowing, fever, mouth breathing, snoring.
Viral supportive care, bacterial strep, antibiotics, penicillin, amoxicillin, finish the course. Post-tonsillectomy, watch for frequent swallowing, sign of bleeding. Avoid red fluid Strachard foods, pain control, hydration.
Asthma, chronic inflammatory airway disorder. Triggers vary. Airways become hyper-responsive, swell, produce mucus.
Symptoms, wheezing, cough, often worse at night with activity, shortness of breath, chest tightness, prolonged expiration, fatigue, maybe low O2 sats.
Averity categories guide treatment.
Yeah.
Meds, SABA, like albuterol for rescue quick relief.
Oh, way.
Hazes, like salmeterol budesonide for control long-term prevention. Others like leukotriene modifiers, montelukast, anticholinergics.
Nursing management. Identify void triggers. Teach proper inhaler technique. Use a spacer. Peak flow meter use. Flu vaccine annually. Teach emergency signs.
Peak expiratory flow rate. PEFR measures airflow. Zones help manage. Green, good control. Yellow, caution, adjust meds. Red, danger, seek help.
Quick NCLEX tips recap. Airway equal priority. Avoid throat exam and epiglottitis. Synagis for high-risk RSV. Understand peak flow zones. No rescue. Save it for controller. ICS, meds for asthma. Watch feeding difficulty as early distress sign in infants. Okay, last major section. Pediatric morbidity and mortality issues.
Leading causes of death vary by age. Under 5, often respiratory.
Yeah.
Older kids, respiratory, mental health, injuries, GI, adolescence, pregnancy issues, mental health, suicide, injuries, MVAs.
Lead poisoning. Risk in older homes. Screen at-risk kids. Prevention involves removing source, cleaning, chelation therapy if levels high. Education is key.
Poisoning. Common under 6 years, especially toddlers exploring. Prevention, safe storage, management, get history assess, labs.
Foreign body obstruction. Common 6 months, 4 years. Putting things in a mouth. Coughing, wheezing, drooling, stridor. Needs prompt intervention. Prevention education vital.
Sudden infant death syndrome, SIDs. Leading cause of death, 112 months. Prevention focuses on safe sleep. Back to sleep. Empty crib.
Child abuse. Physical, sexual, emotional neglect. Be vigilant for indicators, inconsistent injuries, FTT, delayed care, STIs, fear withdrawal, mandatory reporting, documentation, addressing physical psychological needs.
Medical child abuse, Munchausen by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
Caregiver fakes or induces illness in child for attention, rare but serious.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, FASD, from maternal alcohol use during pregnancy. Assess for delays, characteristic features, behavioral issues. Early ID helps with support.
Failure to thrive, FTT. Inadequate weight gain can be organic, medical cause, or non-organic, environmental, psychosocial. Symptoms, poor growth, low tone, lack of engagement, management. Rule out medical causes, monitor weight intake, feeding schedules, family support.
Wow. We have covered an immense amount of ground today, the learner. A true deep dive into pediatric nursing.
We really have. From growth and development through every major system, plus those critical care principles like atraumatic and family-centered care.
This was all designed to give you a strong foundation and review for your pediatric exam. Definitely go back and revisit sections that you felt less sure about.
Absolutely. Use this as a guide alongside your textbooks and notes. Drill down into areas where you need more focus.
We're sending you the best of luck with your studying and your exam. Remember the huge impact you'll have as a pediatric nurse. It's such important work.
It really is. You've got this.